Welcome to Stories to Dismember, and you're hanging out with me, your host, Aaron, and I am here with my two co-hosts, Ariel and Azrael. Woohoo!
Hey, hey.
Hello.
All right, round of applause. Yeah, and we just finished a month on Celtic Horror. Hope you guys enjoyed that. We enjoyed those movies that we covered, and hope you found some useful information on those. I'm sure you did. But it's time to move on. And we are moving on because in the month of April, we're going to do resurrection horror movies. And to kick us off on our very first movie this month is Ariel's pick. And she picked the 1999 movie Resurrection. I'm sure everybody's heard of it, right? No?
I have not heard of this film up until we watched it.
Yeah, this is the first time I seen it. Interesting. If I hadn't seen a few other movies in my life, I might have really enjoyed this one a lot more than I did. It's a little hint, a little spoiler thrown out. Alrighty, since this is Ariel's movie pick, she is going to be the lead investigator on this one. So I'm going to throw it over to her and she can take as many guys she wants. And then we sit in the movie. Yeah. Take whoever you want.
Much like the main protagonist in this film, I also don't have a Cajun accent. So this movie was directed by Russell Mulcahy. Is that how you say his name? Mulcahy? We'll just say for that sake. The lead actor in this film, Christopher Lambert, he was also the he wrote the screenplay. So I thought that was pretty interesting. And also David Cronenberg was in this film. Which was a very weird appearance for this film, but I don't know what the connection is there. This movie was pretty gory, so maybe he liked the body gore, the body horror in this film. But I don't know if he just enjoys doing acting as well as directing. But I thought that was just an interesting kind of guest appearance, if you will. None of the other actors in this movie I found to be like actors that I've seen in a lot of things. There was Leland Orser, who you guys mentioned was also in the Taken series, right?
Yes.
Yeah. I do recognize his character. I guess he kind of gets typecasted a little bit. Robert Joy is also somebody that I've seen in other stuff too. But again, these are not super well-known actors.
Yeah.
At least they're not really acting nowadays.
They're part of that group, what they call them. Like, oh, aren't you that guy from that movie? You know,
yeah. Nobody remembers the name.
Yeah.
Well, and I also feel like they do get typecasted a little bit. So they might have played the same character in another movie, you know, because they've done it once already. And maybe that's how they got the other gig. So I'll get right into the plot. This plot is interesting. It's got some twists. It's got some turns. It's got some gore. So this movie is technically like a horror thriller. But it's going to be a murder, not murder mystery, but kind of a murder cat and mouse kind of movie. So some people might like that. That might be your cup of tea. But if you don't like detective murder stuff, this might not be the movie for you. So we start out the movie where a detective gets a phone call and he's, you know, at home with his wife and he tells her he has to go into work early. And so it seems to be a pretty serious call. Because it's not his normal working hours. And they have a pretty good marriage from the start. It seems like a very loving relationship, which is very odd for a detective, because usually detectives are portrayed as having broken marriages. So I did like this portrayal of their marriage in this movie. Mm-hmm. So he shows up to the case, and it is a murder case. There's like instant jealousy and rivalry from the cops who are already there, because apparently more than one detective got called to the case. And so that was kind of a bad move on the captain to do that, because they immediately kind of start bitching at each other essentially and start, you know, throwing low blows. And we find out that this, you know, our main protagonist, his name is Detective Pulholm or Prudhomme. I think it's Prudhomme. And he's from New Orleans. He does not have a New Orleans accent. Nice. Somewhere between French and New York, or French and maybe Midwestern. And so he shows up and they kind of tell him like, oh, you think you're a hotshot? You think you're better than us? That's why you showed up. Well, this is our case. And he's like, no, I'm going to solve this bitch. And so there's kind of that throughout the whole film, between people not really liking him and being very vocal about it. But I don't actually see why. Did you guys pick up, like, was his character just terrible to be around? Because it just seemed like everybody doesn't like him or hates him, but I couldn't tell why.
Yeah, no, not really. I mean, his boss just said, nobody likes you, but they really didn't get into why or...
Yeah, and he's not a shitty person either. It's not like he's a Sherlock Holmes where he just like says stuff to piss people off. He's actually pretty even the whole movie. He's kind of boring in a sense, you know? He has a partner who makes inappropriate jokes all the time, and he doesn't really laugh, or I guess maybe he's just not part of the team yet. You know, he's not part of their culture. And so his partner is the only one who will actually work with him. Maybe he just kind of outshines people, and maybe nobody wants to be partners with somebody like that. So, but I thought he was a great partner. You know, they had a good partnership in this entire film. So we get our first victim, which we think is victim number one, but this is actually victim number two. They're tied to a chair, and I think they're tied to the chair by their neck. Their right arm is completely severed off. So I think they later said that they died of desanguination, which is like bleeding out. And they notice that there's a weird burn on the back of the victim's neck. And again, this is a pretty gory, like you see the whole arm that got cut off. So the effects in this movie, the special effects were really good, in my opinion, because you get to see everything. And he sees the burn on the back of the neck, and he said, hey, can you open the curtain so we can see it better? They open the curtains and there is blood written on the window saying he's coming. So it's very cryptic. And again, this is the only victim that we know of and that they know of at the time. So they look at the neck even more, and it looks like there was like a cattle prod mark or maybe a taser mark, which subdued the victim to allow the killer to, you know, cut off his arm or get him in the chair at least. And so we find out more about, you know, the characters at the station. Again, his partner is a very joking kind of guy, makes a lot of sexual jokes, and I think there's like a weird humor in this film where it's said that Prudhomme never like laughs at the jokes or doesn't take them seriously. But then when he does, it's like the wrong time, or whenever he tries to make a joke, it just doesn't come off correctly. And I just thought this was a weird humor angle to it. I don't know. But they find out that the victim was alive, like awake and alive. Obviously, they were alive when their arm was cut off, but they were awake for it too, which is very disturbing to hear, because that means the killer inflicted torture to the maximum level for their victims. And they see these Roman numerals on the victims' backs, and there's like a key mark, which I don't know how the key mark got there. Was that burned in there or something? I don't know. But there was like a key impression on the back of his neck, and that was like the burn mark they were talking about that looked weird. They have all these random keys that I guess they collected as evidence, and they match one of the keys to the burn mark. And it's a key for Bismarck Locker Service. They go to the locker, they open it up. There's a wilted flower in there. So again, we're kind of getting introduced to like, okay, this killer is messing with them. Like he wants them to go on a treasure hunt. So they take the wilted flower to their forensic botanist, and she takes a look at it. She identifies it as being the flower from a bottle tree, and maybe it's a specific type of flower from the bottle tree, but the bottle tree is very common here in North America, so maybe it was just a particular strain of that. But she says that the only one that she knows of is in the botanical garden in Chicago. So they go to the botanical garden to go look for this tree specimen. And while they're walking on the ground, they notice that the moss looks like it was recently like kind of laid out. So the detectives say, hey, can you guys lift up the moss? And when they do, there's a dead body under there. And they determine that is actually victim number one, because that victim has been there for quite some time. And the victim they just recently found out about was a very fresh victim. So Just like victim number two, our victim number one has Roman numerals on them. And the Roman numerals are different. We don't know what those are yet at this time, but they later determine that victim number one had 2427 and victim number two had 119. So there is some significance with these numbers, but they don't quite know what the significance is quite yet. They also find out that the blood that was written on the window was lamb's blood. It's not any of the victim's blood. So again, we're kind of tying in like, okay, he's coming, lamb's blood, the movie's called Resurrection. This is kind of like an Easter movie. So it just so happens that Easter is coming up in the movie's timeline. So they're kind of making the connections there a little bit at this point. And before we, you know, figure out anything else about the story, we have to do a flashback to why this detective is so fucked up, right? Because we just got it. And he's looking out the window at his home. He's looking at an empty hammock. And that takes him back to when his son died. And this scene just really got me, but not in a good way. He was, you know, teaching his son how to ride a bike. And in 90s fashion, he got, you know, knocked over by a guy on rollerblades. And the kid just kept going. You know, he was so excited. He finally learned how to ride his bike with his little tricycle wheels on. And he rode right into traffic and got hit by a car, which was a very, like, tough scene to watch because they actually used, like, a kid's sized body double.
Yes.
And they watched the car hit the kid. It was like,
yeah, it was.
I wonder if David Cronenberg had a lot to, like, a lot of influence on this film.
Yeah, I wonder because it was really graphic when I saw it. I was like,
yeah,
damn. I mean,
yeah. And that sort of scene where you're like, holy shit, they actually went there, you know, because it was very realistic looking. And then right after that, we see him. Like, we go back to him at the window, and he's just got a very weird kind of react. The acting was kind of bad from his part. He just goes, no! And then he just, like, kind of, like, puts his fists up in the air. It was very weird. And he's not crying or anything. It's just, it was, like, the first take, in my opinion.
Well, they did show his very expensive watch when he was, you know,
holding right. in front of his face. Brought to you by Rolex.
Right.
Yeah, I just thought the reaction was pretty funny just because of the way he said no. It was just kind of, again, his character is very flat, right? Doesn't have a lot of inflection in his voice too much in this. And maybe that's his acting style. I have no idea. I didn't watch Highlander with him in it. I don't remember him in Highlander.
I'm watching Highlander in other things. That's just Christopher Lambert. That's just...
Okay, that's just the way he acts?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. Gotcha. Okay, well, you know, then he's not terrible at acting. That's just the way he acts. But maybe this character or maybe that scene just shouldn't have been put in there if that's the way he would have delivered the line. So,
right.
But yeah, so we figure out that he lost his son. And it's the way he's acting kind of seems like it was a long time ago, but it was actually a year ago, which is quite astonishing that he would be sort of internalizing it the way he is, or that his wife would be internalizing it the way that she is. It kind of seems like it's been a while based on how they're just kind of living their lives. Yeah. So I was quite shocked to hear it had only been a year. So we get that scene and we don't really revisit that. It's referenced later on again, but it's not really a huge part of the plot. I don't think it really... It just kind of is there to tell us that he's kind of a closed off person when it comes to his feelings. And he has a hard time talking to his wife about the incident or really anything that's going on in his life. There was like one moment where they're talking and she had mentioned the murders and he's like, I don't want to talk about it. So I guess it kind of explains that reaction of him not wanting to open up. So they get another call to another murder. This is victim number three. They walk into this building. It's a very dilapidated sort of apartment, low income, crack house, whorehouse. I don't know what to describe it as. Just,
A little bit of everything, I think.
Yeah, people walking around naked. There is some nudity in this movie, which was quite surprising to me.
Yeah.
We get full male nudity and full female nudity, which was surprising.
Full body nudity, yeah.
Yeah, 1999. again, David Cronenberg probably, you know, he's like, come on, you got to get some nude shots in here. So he's walking around, you know, there's people strung out everywhere, and they go to this really kind of gross, dingy, grungy looking like bathroom, like a community bathroom area. And there is a body sitting on the toilet with no head. And
totally naked.
Yeah.
As well.
Totally naked. Yeah. You don't really see anything, though. It's just him sitting on the toilet. But his partner starts freaking out. Like, his partner's like, I am looking at a body with no head. Like, yeah. He's like, this shit's real. Like,
he did lose his
it's
shit
starting
on that
to become clear that every victim has like something missing, right? So victim number one had like their left arm cut off. Victim number two had their right arm cut off. And this guy's got his head cut off. And so we're starting to see a pattern here of body parts missing. And it's just getting more amped up, right? It's just getting more grotesque. And so I was quite shocked that they got a call of a dead body, but they didn't like close down the scene or like get everybody out of the building. Everyone was still kind of just like walking around like normal when they got there. But they eventually get, you know, all the forensic people to come in and ask, you know, anyone who was in the building if they've seen anything. But again, they're all strung out and probably don't want to talk to the police. So they don't really get any information there. They again see like the Roman numerals on there, and they're trying to, you know, figure out. I think the partner was making a reference, oh, they're Roman numerals, they're not numbers, and there's a huge difference. And, you know, so we start to get like this scene where Detective Prudhomme is trying to figure out the numbers, right? He's like, are they dates? Can I add them up? You know, he's like adding them up, subtracting them, like trying to do numerology essentially. And I was like yelling at the TV at this point, like, they're fucking Bible passages, like they're chapters and verses. Come on now, the lamb's blood, it's about to be Easter. Like, I thought he, like being like the big shot that everybody thought he was, would have picked this up like the first go and would have been like, oh, I know this, it's chapters and verses. But he eventually gets there.
Yeah.
And so he realizes that the victim's names also coincide with the chapters and verses. So I forgot what they were. I didn't write them down, but like, you know, Paul something something, right?
Yeah,
or
Peter,
David something something, Peter Matthew something something. So he starts reading the passages, and they do have some sort of like cryptic meaning to the overall like kind of, I guess, pathology of the killer. And so he goes back home, you know, after kind of coming up with this revelation, I guess, no pun intended. And he goes home, and there's a priest there. And I guess it's their priest for their Catholic church. And he's there doing a house call because his wife had called the priest to come and talk to John. His name's John. And so the priest comes to talk to John because he's been very withdrawn. And, you know, his wife says, you haven't even really visited the grave, or you're not really grieving our son's death. And, you know, I lost a son too, and you're not really being there for me as a husband. And, you know, he does feel really bad, and he kind of owns up to it very quickly, but he has like a very visceral reaction with the priest, and he's very dismissive of religion and kind of rejects any consolation that the priest has to provide him. So he's already kind of got this toxic relationship with the priest, and the priest is David Cronenberg. This is his role, which, you know, isn't the only scene he's in. He does kind of play a little bit of a part in this movie. And so he kind of has this turning moment where he realizes, I need to like pull up my bootstraps and start being myself again, right? Because the situation's only going to get worse if I keep being like this. So he tries to have like a different kind of outlook or attitude about life. And so he goes into work the next day, and, you know, his partner is talking amongst some other detectives, or, you know, detectives, and they're having a conversation, and he's thinking that the partner is making another one of his stupid sexual jokes. And so he just like kind of shows up and starts laughing to kind of be more receptive, I guess, to the conversation. And they look at him all weird, and he goes, that joke was so funny. And he's like, I'm not making a joke. And the other detective goes, yeah, my sister was just hit by a bus. it was a very weird scene to have that in there. I don't know what the purpose of that was. Do you guys know, maybe like plot wise, what that was about?
No clue.
It seemed kind of out of place.
It was an awkward laugh, though.
Yeah. <For him. laughs> I just don't know like why they put that in there. Maybe that was like the director's humor or something. Or maybe that's, you know, the actor's humor. Christopher Lambert, that's the way he likes to
joke. He's going
to
love this scene.
He's like, now I wrote the screenplay, guys. Remember that. I'm putting in this joke. So I guess this happens again later on when he tries to make a joke and it's just really bad, you know. So we get another comedic relief kind of scene. I just thought the joke was weirdly placed. And also I was like, why now? You know, like, I guess it's just because he's so far removed from these guys. Like, he does not know how to connect to them. So maybe that was kind of why it was put in there, to show that he's really not part of their group at all. Like, he just can't make it work. So the captain decides to bring in a forensic psychologist, somebody who does psychopathy on serial killers. And the detective, you know, John, he's kind of laughing it off, like, oh, what is he going to say? Like, it's a male 25 to 45 white male that's a recluse, you know, that is a pillar of their community or whatever. So he goes in to go meet the forensic psychologist, and he tells him exactly that, like exactly what he said. And he starts busting up laughing.
Yeah.
And even the guy's like, did I say something funny? And he's like, no, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. So just kind of having an off day, I guess. We don't actually really get anything from the psychologist, except for maybe, you know, he kind of ties in all these religious elements to it. And I don't know, he didn't really give them anything to chew on. They were kind of already there to begin with. But at first I thought, like, oh, are they going to bring the psychologist with them on this investigation? But then he was like, oh, yeah, call me if you need anything. I just thought it was weird that they kind of all walked out together. And I thought maybe the psychologist was going to be part of the team now. But he goes off and does his own thing. And so we start getting like communications from the killer, right? The killer, it's kind of becoming obvious the killer is leaving these clues intentionally. And even though it's risky, and the killer could be caught by making a mistake, like the whole chase is really appealing to the killer. And so they get a fax from the killer, and the fax is kind of just kind of cryptic and talking to the detectives and saying that the third victim, and again, the killer is probably sending this because they had not made the connection yet, but the third victim has another clue inside of them. And so they're like, oh, great. So now we got to go back and like look in this body. And so they go back to the coroner, the medical examiner, and they're like, hey, you know, did you finish your autopsy? He says, yeah, I'm just running the report now. And they said, did you maybe find anything weird besides his head being cut off? And he goes, yeah, there was a lot of olives in this guy's stomach. And I guess one of the fax lines is about a mountain or something, like a mount, and I guess Mount Olive or something. I don't know. It had a biblical reference and it led them somewhere. It also had like, they figured out that this mountain of olives is tied to Mark 3:17 of Boanerges or Boanerges. He even has a hard time, you know, kind of saying it. And he goes to the priest at the church, the same priest that he saw earlier, to kind of ask for help, because he didn't really understand this connection. And the priest also helps him figure out how to say it, which I didn't pay attention enough to put in my notes. But I thought it was kind of funny when the priest answers the door, because he like shows up in like a Hugh Hefner silk robe. And I'm just like, do priests just walk around the church in their silk robes? I know they have like a living quarters, but I didn't know they like walk throughout the rest of the church like that.
He's got a silk robe and martini and cigarette. I
thought this scene was also very interesting because John will not enter the church. Like, he kind of stays outside of the church, probably because his son was, you know, had his ceremony there, like his funeral ceremony there. But he, the priest is like, okay. And he just like goes to the Bible and is like reading them the passage, and they're like 10 feet away from each other. So they do kind of figure out, you know, more indications from these passages kind of leading him to figure out that there is more intent from the killer, and there's more clues, you know, to be had about each victim. So now he's, anytime he goes to a scene, he's looking for clues, essentially. So they are looking around. I guess they get like tipped off based on that passage to go to this another rundown building, I guess. There's a lot of rundown buildings in Chicago, so you just take your pick. And so they go to this crime scene that, or where, what they think is where the killer is like chopping up his victims. And they go there, or at least keeping the body parts, because he's taking the body parts with him. So they go there, and it's kind of like an art gallery setup. There's some weird like photography and paintings and stuff all hung around. And so it just looks like a storage room. And we see the killer in that really weird, it's almost like a mask from The Town That Dreaded Sundown. It's just got like two little eye holes and like a mouth hole, I think, or a nose hole. And it's kind of looks like a cloth, like a cotton bag over his head. And he's got these gloves on, and he's doing like a Vogue pose to stay still. I just thought that pose was kind of funny, where he's like trying to do like a Vogue, and he's just like trying to stay super still to blend in with all the weird art, which it kind of works. And so he's, you know, he's the killer. He's there. And as John is going through the building, he like hears something, and he runs in there, and there's a dude that's like tied up with his freaking leg cut off already. And the leg's on the ground, and he's freaking out because this guy just dies in front of him. And it's very emotional for John, because he's, you know, kind of experiencing those emotions all over again with his son. And so it's a very intense scene. His partner catches up. They notice the leg is still on the ground. So he says to his partner, the killer is still here. And so now they're calling, you know, everyone in to come in as backup. But the killer, you know, makes it out, essentially. So we know at this point, you know, one leg has been cut off this victim. So we're assuming another leg will be cut off of another victim, and that this whole thing isn't over yet. As they're like chasing the killer through the building, they're like jumping and doing parkour and everything. Not really. There's just jumping over roofs from one building to the next. It would be so funny if they did parkour. Again, it would totally go with the whole vibe of this movie, just having weird ass moments and little tidbits. And again, he wrote the script. So he's like, and here the main character does a kickflip off of the wall. He has like a stunt double come in. Anyway, so as they're chasing after him, I guess the partner kind of gets separated from the rest of everyone else and gets tased in the back of the neck. And so I thought at this point, shit, the killer's going to abduct this guy. But I don't remember what his name is. His name's Andrew, the partner's name. So I'm like, okay, I don't remember Andrew being in the Bible. So maybe we're good. You know what I mean? And so... Yeah, the Book of Andy. I don't remember that one. So so I think the partner's okay. Maybe he's safe based off of his name. And then we see what looks like the killer coming out from the building, but kind of walking weird. And there's like kind of a, not a standoff, right? It's just all the police officers have their guns drawn, and the killer's walking towards them, and he has a gun. And they're kind of ready to shoot and fire. But John notices the way that he's walking, he feels like it's a setup, right? And he, right as he says, like, don't shoot, they shoot this guy in the leg with a shotgun. I was surprised the shotgun was able to, like, shoot that far. But yeah, I mean, they blew his leg, not off, but they blew a huge amount of it off. And he falls to the ground, and they realize that it was Andrew. And he had like duct tape on his nose and his mouth. So he was like suffocating. That's why he was like walking really weird. And he was like all dazed and confused from being tased. So thankfully he's alive. You know, they take him to the hospital. Unfortunately, they do have to, you know, cut his leg off. But it's like from the, I think it's like from the knee down, is it? Or maybe it's higher up and they cut the whole thing off. But I thought this part was kind of weird because the killer steals the leg. Like, I guess this killer just has, like, some compulsion to steal limbs, like, severed limbs. And I thought that part was kind of funny where they're like, you know, he's like, don't make them, or don't have them take my leg. Don't have them take my leg. And then they cut it off, and then the killer steals the leg. So now he's definitely not getting his leg back.
The doctor's like, I know he has to take your leg. Yeah, we can't find it.
We don't know where it is. the killer is now leaving voicemails to John, and you know the voicemail is kind of saying, it's like cryptic, but it's saying that he's going to feel the remorse of his wife's death next. And I thought this part was really fucked up because he mentions his kid's death, you know, and so now he's pretty much saying, like, now your wife's gonna die and that's gonna be on your conscience as well. And so now he realizes, we got to get everyone to my house, you know, like, we got to protect my wife. And so by the time he shows up, John shows up to his house, they've already got it, like, locked down and all the tape up and everything. So he must work far away, you know, if you think about it. That was a pretty long time. And he walks in. They're trying to tell him, like, you don't want to go in there. You don't want to go in there. And we see blood everywhere. And I'm like, fuck, the wife is dead, you know. He gets in there. He's uncontrollable. They tell him don't touch the body, but they let him touch it anyways, which I'm pretty sure isn't protocol. And he turns over the body, and it's actually his wife's best friend who was visiting in town. And he's still pretty distraught. You know, this is his wife's best friend. It's kind of like a sister-in-law to him, but he's relieved at the same time that it's not his wife. And then his wife shows up. She was at the store getting groceries, and she comes back. And he kind of tells her what happens because he's got blood all over his hands and there's police everywhere. And he tells her, you know, Jenny's dead. And she, out of acting chops, has everyone beat in this whole film. Her reactions are on point. I loved her acting compared to everyone else's in this film. And she is just like sobbing and breaking down. And it's just very like visceral of a reaction from her. And so, They put out like to the public the voicemail so that everyone can hear the voice of the killer and say, look, if anyone recognizes this voice, let us know, because we're, you know, trying to track this guy down. And they do get a tip, and somebody says, you know, I think one of my, you know, she was like a landlord or something. She goes, I think I used to rent to this guy, or I knew this guy, and it kind of sounds like his voice. So they go to this guy's house and guns drawn and everything, because again, they think they have the killer. And unfortunately, it is a blind guy, because they do find a bunch of books in Braille, and they even tell him, like, can you repeat this line? And he's repeating it with their guns drawn, and it sounds exactly like him. And he's like, wait, hold on. This guy's blind. They can't be the killer, because how does he like cut these limbs off with surgical precision?
It was kind of cool. It's kind of cool when they were talking to him. When they were talking to him, they're like, repeat this line, and they're looking at him, talking to him, and he's like facing sideways, looking somewhere else.
Yeah, exactly. And usually in movies too, it wouldn't be so odd for the killer to be facing the other direction with his back to the police officers, speaking cryptically. You know, I'm just kind of, you know, thinking of like the movie Seven, where, you know, Kevin Spacey's character kind of does that a lot, where he's like always not facing them and like talking cryptically. But you know, he puts his hand in front of the guy's face to like make sure and check that he's actually blind. And the guy says that he was actually paid by a guy in a park who approached him to do the voice narration because he was looking for people to narrate some lines for, you know, people that had unique voices. I thought this was pretty funny because the blind guy says, you know, $50 is $50.
Yeah. Sound like a bunch of bullshit to me, but bucks fit bucks.
Yeah, because he's like, I don't think the guy was actually wanting me to do some voice acting. That was definitely bullshit, but $50 is $50. And $50 in 1999 was a lot of money. That could buy you 2 video games back then.
Mm-hmm.
So we do have a victim number 5, and it's in a meat cooler, and they're hanging upside down from their ankles, which is always super unsettling to see. And his leg is cut off. So Detective Andrew's leg was not enough of a leg for this killer to be satisfied. So he actually had to go out and kill somebody else and get more leg, which I don't know if we ever find out what happens to Detective Andrew's leg. But anyways, maybe it's just a souvenir. I don't know.
Yeah.
So at this point, Detective John is like, okay, well, I got to figure out this psychologist dude. I got to pick his brain a little bit more. I need some more information. So he goes to talk to the, he tries to track down the forensic psychologist, right? He gets where he works and he shows up there and he's like asking like, where the heck is this guy? I want to talk to him. He's really upset. Do you guys remember why he was so upset? I can't really remember what the whole point of him being there at the office and why he was all uppity about it. Maybe he wasn't returning his calls or something. He was really pissed.
No, it was, but yeah,
it was a strange reaction.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. Maybe there, I can't, again, I obviously wasn't paying too much attention to these details as to why he went there, but he finds out that the guy that comes out, which I guess he's looking for like what, Detective Wingate or something is his name.
Yeah.
Right. And so, he goes to the office and this dude comes out and he goes, what the hell is the problem? And he's like, I'm looking for Detective Wingate. And he's like, bro, I am Detective Wingate. And it is not the detective that we saw earlier.
Totally opposite.
I'm totally opposite. Boom. Aaron, can you describe who these guys are and how different they look?
Well, the original, the first Wingate, you know, kind of nerdy, white guy, glasses, you know, typical. And, you know, detected the real Detective Wingate, you know.
The OG.
You know, he's a black guy, cool looking. You know, he looks like an FBI agent.
With some years on him, too. He's like in his 50s.
Yeah, and, you know, he's been around. Yeah. So, yeah, like I was saying, it's just like when he came in, and he's like, I'm looking for Detective Wingate. And he's like, I am Detective Wingate, fool. And Christopher Ann was like, but.
And it all comes together now. Did you guys have any inkling at this point? Like, did you think that it was the forensic psychologist who might be the killer?
Well, honestly, no, because they did so little with him other than,
yeah, that's true.
You know, maybe we could have got more. We got more with Clue when they were at the cafe talking to each other.
Yeah, there was a cafe scene where this is the part that grosses me out in films. He took a bite of pizza and then took a swish of coffee while chewing the pizza. I hate when people do that in movies because pizza and coffee don't mix. Anyways,
they were at a cafe.
Yeah, that was my clue that he was the killer. Right. Honestly, I was like, who does that? I mean, he wasn't eating pizza with a fork, but, you know, pretty close.
Crazy motherfucker. Yeah.
So I actually picked this up very early on when we first saw the forensic psychologist. And it was like kind of weird to me. It was just the way he was behaving when they were talking about the case. Number one, he wanted to see the entire file of the case, which isn't abnormal for a forensic guy to have to see the entire case files in order to make a prediction about the killer's psychopathy or pattern. But when they received like the facts and he was in the room, he kind of like leaned in a weird way to where I was like, this guy is very invested in this. And it's almost like he wants to me, it came off like he was wanting to see John's reaction as he read the facts. Right. And I just thought that was really weird. And then when this happened, I was like, I fucking knew it. The pizza, the coffee, him leaning in, it all makes sense now. But I was thinking like, okay, I had two possibility killers in my brain. It was either David Cronenberg, because it's David Cronenberg, or it was the forensic psychologist. Those were my two at the time. I was like, it's got to be one or the other at this point. So now we know for sure it's the guy that he was talking to who saw the entire case file. But it doesn't matter because he's been killing all the guys. So he knows everything about the killings. But he also knows what they know. And that's the part that's kind of tricky at this point. So what John does is he goes, okay, I'm going to pretend like I need to talk to him again. We have some new information. I want to pick his brain. We're going to set this up at the cafe that we were at before where I lost my shit. Because there was like a scene where he like raises his voice and then Everybody's kind of looking at him. And then like one of the, I don't know if this was intentional or not, but they had like one of those bug zappers in the back that restaurants have. And right as he was looking at the kid with the mohawk, like a giant bug like ran into the, to the zapper and just like zapped hella loud. But anyways, just a little detail. So I thought this wasn't going to work, but it actually does. The guy falls for it and shows up at the pizza place, or the cafe, I should say. And I figured he would be smart enough not to fall for it, but I think his ego kind of led him there. Yeah. So they surround him, and I kind of thought this part was funny where they've got all the guns drawn on him. And he's like, it was you the whole time. He's like, you're not Wingate. And he kind of puts up his arms like, you know, kind of like, well, I guess you got me. Kind of like, well, I guess I'm cut. So they take him to the interrogation room. He's pleading the fifth. He's like, killer? What are you talking about? Which bodies? Oh, the ones you gave me all the files on? I don't know what you're talking about. And he's like, I'm just killing time until my attorney gets here. And he's just being, you know, he's playing coy. And he already knows they don't really have that much evidence on him. So, you know, it's looking pretty good for him and pretty bad for the detectives. And at this time, Prudhomme like loses his shit in the investigation room, and they end up pulling him out because he's about to punch this guy in the face because he's being kind of a dick at this point to the detective. They know that they don't have a lot on him for the murders, and they know that they only have a certain amount of time. I forgot if it's like 24 hours or 48 hours that they can hold somebody without charges, but that time is running out. And so they're trying to get him charged without bail for impersonating a federal officer, but he gets bail and it's like $20,000. So All he's got to pay is like, what, $2,000 to get out to post bail. So
unless it's first offense, then you get to 4,000.
Well, and they couldn't find him in the system. So he's like, what do you got on me? I have no like record. I've got, you know, they even said like, we don't know what his identity is. Like, we don't know who this guy is. We don't really have any records on him. And they kind of start like tying him to other murders, right? From other states, because they're starting to make these connections in Tennessee. And I think like Oklahoma, where men were killed and their body parts were like removed in those murders, and it kind of follows the same MO as this killer. So now they're thinking, oh, well, he's been like all over the country doing this shit. So they start making that connection, and I think they said that they were able to find like institutional records where he was in an insane asylum for some time, and that's when the murder stopped. But he's essentially like a serial killer that's been doing this for, you know, like a decade. So they have to release him because they ran out of time and they were really pushing it. They were trying really hard to get some evidence. They let him go. What does he do? He kills somebody else. That's exactly what he does. So victim number six had their torso taken. And at this point, I'm like, all right, we got two arms, we got a head, we got two legs, and now we got a torso. We got ourselves a Franken-Jesus. And so that's where this is headed.
Victim number six kind of killed himself. Because he was walking up the stairs next to all the plastic. And when he came up behind him, he fell in the plastic and then wrapped himself up.
That's true. Like, what's it called? Final Destination?
Yeah.
In the shower scene? Yeah. This is kind of that where he does get suffocated by the killer. But yeah, you shouldn't have that much plastic in your home. So they do find the Franken-Jesus. Very well put together. We got all the parts. Probably Detective Andrew's leg is somewhere in there. I don't know. Maybe. And I think it's kind of funny because they like walk into this building that's, you know, run down, another rundown building in Chicago. And this is where the killer's kind of been doing his thing. He's got his little altar and all these like files and everything everywhere. And they walk into the room and they instantly see this Franken-Jesus like that's on the cross. And everybody starts vomiting, right? But I'm like, wouldn't you have smelled that before you saw it?
Right.
Again, with the whole moss thing at the botanical garden, those greenhouses are very humid. You definitely would have smelled that body. You wouldn't have had to pull up the moss. Or they could have been like, oh, that's our new carry-on flower that just bloomed. So it kind of smells like death in here. You know, but in this room, this setting, there's no flowers or plants. So everybody, I just think it's funny how everybody that walks into the room and sees this, you know, art piece that he's been working on instantly starts vomiting, projectile vomiting everywhere. So they start looking at like all his like little paper clippings and files, and they realize he's not done. Like, even though he's made this Franken-Jesus, there's still, he's like used these kind of tools to open up the chest cavity. And they're like, shit, we gotta get the, what is it called? Like the Immaculate Heart or something like that. I forgot what it's called, but essentially maybe it's called the Sacred Heart. Yeah. I thought it was called like the Immaculate Heart because it comes from like Mary giving birth, you know, to the Immaculate Conception, but I could be wrong about that. But it is like that little Catholic heart symbol where it has like the little crown around it and it's on fire. And so they're like, okay, well, we know he likes biblical names and he needs a heart. And so he's probably, you know, going to kill a woman named Mary who's going to give birth after midnight because tomorrow is Easter, right? And again, I'm assuming this is like all like each victim is one day leading up to Easter. And that's why the seven victims represent the 7 days that the, you know, the whole earth was created or whatnot, the whole universe. So the seventh day being Easter. And so they're going to go to all these hospitals and look for a woman named Mary. And they go to this one hospital. And as they show up, they see the killer leaving. He's like dressed up as a nurse and he's leaving one of the delivery rooms with a newborn. And so they immediately flag him down and start chasing after him. They're going through the building. They make it up to the top of the building. And this part was pretty hard to watch because this like newborn baby that they made looked very realistic. And he's dangling the baby over the building's edge. And he's like, well, 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 what a predicament we got here. I'm asking you to drop the gun and I might drop this baby if you don't, you know? And he's just being like really psychotic, like full blown psychotic at this point. Because up until now, he's been pretty even with his like psychosis, you know, like under wraps. He hasn't really shown reaching that next level, but now we see him like full blown psycho. And I thought he was going to take the heart of Mary, but apparently he wants to take the heart of the baby, or the baby was like the last sacrifice, which is really messed up. He, you know, John goes to like subdue him. He gets stabbed in the palm by the killer and he drops the baby with the other hand. But then John catches the baby in the other hand right before the baby falls. And he ends up, you know, stumbling back with the newborn, and then he shoots the killer in the chest. Killer keeps coming at him. He shoots him in the head. Guy falls over the edge. No more. We don't see him ever again. So, yeah, I mean, that's pretty much it at this point. Like, that's kind of next to that's like the second scene to the end scene where everybody kind of pulls everything together. He goes back to his life. He's trying to improve himself. And that's where it ends.
The end.
The end. And guy falls off a building.
And his partner said he's coming back. He's going to learn how to walk again.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, that's kind of the wrap up there. Yeah. Like all the tie-ins, like, you know, he's trying to walk again. And we find out that, you know, now they're starting to become more friends and he's trying to make jokes with him. And he's like, you really got to work on your jokes, man. They're really bad.
Terrible.
So, yeah. That is Resurrection 1999.
All right. That was a ride. This is the part of our show where we do our reviews and ratings, and we do rate on a 10 scale. So 1 to 10, or 0 to 10 if you really hate it, I guess. And we do try to come up with a saying or a title for our rating, kind of give it maybe some humor or horror or just whatever you like. And since this is Ariel's movie, she gets to go last with the final words. And I think we'll go ahead and let Azrael kick off this one, see what he thought of Resurrection 99.
Okay. yeah, this was my first time watching this movie. I did, it took me a while to get into it. I think I first started watching it and then I turn it off maybe after 10 minutes. I'm like, I have to come back to it later. Just didn't, and I wasn't feeling it. But about like 20 minutes of the movie, I think it started picking up, and I started, you know, I got into the movie. I really enjoyed the gore, you know, the gory scenes. I think the movie had the right amount of creepiness and unsettling scenes. You both kind of previously mentioned this, that the film was similar to the movie Seven, which I think it came out like, what, 95? So I could see why a lot of people might have not liked it, because it didn't get a lot of good reviews online, it seemed like, on Rotten Tomatoes. But I think if you like these type of gritty detective stories, then it's one definitely worth watching. I enjoyed it ultimately at the end. So with that, I would give this movie 4.9 Frankenchrists.
All right. Oh, man, you took my item. I'm going to have to think of something else now.
Oh. Well, you said, what was yours, Franken?
Franken I said Franken Jesus.
Oh, yeah. That's right. My bad.
4.9. That's pretty good. This also is my first time watching this movie, which is kind of surprised me since it did come out in 99, and I've actually never even heard of it. Yeah, we discussed a lot in the movie, you know, especially some of the acting fell flat sometimes. And that can happen. I don't know if maybe some actors just don't try as hard when they're doing a horror movie, or I don't know. I can't explain it sometimes. And I think it does suffer from being released really close to the movie Seven, which it gets compared to a lot. If you put that aside and you look at the movie on its own merits, it's still, you know, has a formula. It's dark, it's creepy. You got a serial killer, you know, there's religious overtones, you know, it's dark and foreboding, and you see a lot of imagery. So it has, you know, kind of follows the formula that way, which is not all bad if you do it right. I don't know if this was done right, honestly. I wouldn't say it's a terrible movie, but it could have been better, I believe. Maybe change it up a little different. It maybe not so it wouldn't be compared to other movies, you know, around its time. I would say, I would if I were you, I mean, it's easy to find. It's on Tubi. Shout out. You can go ahead and put it on your list. Check it out if you got an hour and a half to waste, or an hour and 47 minutes because you got to watch commercials. I would say it's middle of the road. I mean, I kind of like Christopher Lambert. We talked about him earlier. You just kind of get Christopher Lambert the same in every movie. I would give this movie 5 chest spreaders out of 10.
All right.
All right. I made it through.
Okay. So I am last. I'll try to keep this short. Lighting, really bad. Cinematography was like CSI, like the TV show CSI. Lots of like very 90s cuts. So it was very low budget in my opinion, but I do like the effects. Like I thought the effects were really good, and I felt like this movie kind of put stuff in there that even Seven didn't do, you know? So I am going to rate it low, but I do want to give it some points for the efforts that it made. I just felt like had they casted differently and maybe rewrote the plot a little bit better, I think this could have been a really good movie. The cinematography, though, is just really bad. And lighting is just, I don't know what kind of filters they were using, but this movie was so dark. And it had a lot of like blue filters and green and yellow filters. It just was very much of its time and the way that movies were made back then. But again, like you said, Aaron, Seven did it a lot better in terms of just the way it was shot and the way that the story played out. So because of that, I'm going to give it 3 out of 10 pizza bites and coffee sips.
Terrible. Yeah, and just to a little continuation, I got my train of thought back. Both you guys talked about it. There is some gore in this movie. There is some violence against children. And a lot of the stuff they showed looked very, like they tried to make it look as realistic as possible.
Yeah.
In a lot of the scenes.
I just felt like the lighting and the cinematography kind of ruined it.
Yeah. Well, might have helped it in some scenes, but yeah. Detective Prudhomme said it the best at one of the first scenes in the movie. We need more light.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
Could have helped.
Yeah, also $50 is $50, and I'm sure $50 could have bought some lights.
Right.
At least a few.
Who's the lighting guy? Oh, we didn't think we needed one.
He quit.
Yeah. All right. Well, the next movie we are going to do is a pick from yours truly, and it is the 1994 movie The Crow.
Yes.
Yay.
I love this movie. I hope it held up over time. I'm really hoping it held up over time.
I know.
Azra, I haven't seen it in a while.
I know Azra says he has certain movies that he watches, you know, yearly. Yeah, this is.
Do you watch this one every year on Easter?
Should be my new Easter movie. Yeah, no, but I do watch this movie every year, at least a couple times a year. And I will say, it probably has, if not the best soundtrack, it's in the top five. And I'll fight you with that one about that one.
I'll have to re-listen to the soundtrack, but I have a feeling, based on what I remember, this movie's also going to be very darkly lit, but it did it in such a good way. So
yeah, they did it for effect, not just to be dark.
Right.
Yeah.
They didn't put a bunch of filters on it.
Right. I'm excited for us to cover The Crow. And as a special treat, guess what?
What?
I'm going to do the review on this movie.
Oh, you are?
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Azrael's like, but this is the only one I wanted to do it on.
He's like, damn it.
You took this away from me. You know what? Just because you took this away from Azrael, I'm going to take away your quote. What's in the box?
Well, yeah, we forgot to tell you guys, before he saw the Frankenchrist, he was like, what's in the room? I'm just kidding. I don't know. Am I kidding? You might have to watch it and find out. No. Let's see.
What's in the
room? That's how close it was to seven. When he got to like his house and he saw the blood and he thought his wife was dead, he was like, what's on the floor?
Put the gun down, John. Just put your gun down, John. Don't listen to
him. Well, this has been fun.
Yeah.
It has been
fun. I hope everyone enjoyed their Easter.
Yes, happy Easter. And don't forget to join us next time for The Crow. Watch it first if you want to. You can follow along with us. And if you had never seen it, oh wow, you're in for a treat. You really are.
Mm-hmm.
So
definitely watch it. Otherwise, this review is not going to be as fun.
Yeah. Okay. Well, if you have any suggestions for movies for us to cover, it doesn't necessarily have to follow anything we're doing. We'd love to hear from you at storiestodismember@gmail.com, or you can hit us up on our social medias, Instagram, TikTok, Facebook. Just search Stories to Dismember. You can find us there. You can also text or give us a voicemail at 817-405-4196. We always love to hear from you guys, and we love you guys.
Yeah, but don't hire a blind guy to leave the voicemail, okay?
If you do, make him say exactly what he said in the movie. Oh, yeah.
$50 is $50.
$50. Shit. Times is hard.
Yeah, you know what? Actually, just leave us a voicemail and say just that. That right. would be awesome. Give us your best line of $50 is $50.
And if you want to donate $50, our PayPal is. Just joking. All right. Well, on that note, I guess we'll let you guys go, and we'll see you on the next episode.
Later.
Bye-bye.
See ya.
Thank you for listening to the Stories to Dismember podcast. Please be sure to tell your friends, subscribe, and leave a rating. You can contact us at storiestodismember@gmail.com, and we'd love to hear from you. You can also follow us on TikTok at storiestodismember. The music for Stories to Dismember is provided by Windfeather. Can't wait to hang out with you next time. Bye-bye. For those of you wondering, yeah, there's a new one coming out, which I think people already hate, but I am going to check it out when it finally comes out.
So wait, how many, is this the third one or are there more?
The new one that's coming out?
Yeah.
It's actually, they're starting over. Like,
But this is like the third film in that series, like that they've made in total.
Yeah,
like,
I think there was a few of them.
Yeah, there's.
Oh, were there? Yeah. Oh, okay. I stopped after two because I didn't really like two, so I just stopped after that.
Yeah, they went low budget after that.
Yeah, yeah. Crow Salvation, I think.
Yeah.
Oh, gotcha. Okay. Okay, yeah. Gotcha.
So,
do we know who's casted as the Crow?
Guy who played it.
Yeah, Skarsgård.
Yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Interesting. Hmm. But can he fight? I guess we'll have to find out. Yes, I mean, to be honest, they're really putting, what's his name, like Bill Skarsgård?
Yeah.
They're really putting Bill Skarsgård through like all of the roles, right? Like pretty soon we're going to see him in like some sort of musical or something. La La Land.
I won't. Somebody else will. Yeah.
The Crow, the musical.
Yeah.
Because I feel like he's doing it all at this point. Like he's getting casted in so much stuff.
Yeah.
But I mean, he's a Skarsgård. They get casted in a lot of stuff, you know.
Guess he's one of the.
I mean, even his brother was casted to be in a Lady Gaga music video. So.
So yeah.
Maybe this one will be casted in Ariana Grande's.